to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, what do Christmas and a cat in the desert have in common?
I don't know.
Sandy Claus?
No. No. First off, we're recording this as a bonus episode that's not supposed to be seasonal.
Oh, right. I forgot.
Secondly,
John,
if you're going...
I forgot about that.
If you're going to make it seasonal, make the joke good.
I love that joke. It was one of my favorites. I think I've used
Sandy
it before
Claus?
On Sandy Claus. Anyway,
Sandy Claus?
John, what? Yeah. Which dog?
No. I did not mean. I want a second joke.
Which dog is always going to win the race?
Which one?
It's the one with the most comfortable lead.
No.
Because that's what they call leashes in England.
I refuse to. I get the joke. I refuse to accept it. Okay.
All right. Well,
I have received.
I can use the Sandy Claus joke when we record for the actual Christmas time.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I can save it. It's my favorite joke. One of my favorites.
I don't accept
that. And why did the cowboy get a dachshund?
Hank, the solution to having told
because he wanted
two...
to get a long little doggy.
I do like that joke, but you've told it to me 500 times.
I know, it's so good.
It's not that good, man.
It's just as good as the moth. And I've heard the moth more than you've heard the long... And also, the moth is way longer than the long doggy.
It is nowhere near as good as... Like, what is the metaphorical resonance of the get a long little doggy joke?
None.
What is the part of it where we have to grapple with the reality that so much of our lives is spent flying toward a light that we neither understand nor consider?
It's the exact same thing. It's because we make decisions not based on what we actually want, but based on what society expects of us, which is that cowboys get a long little doggy.
I'm sorry, man.
It works.
And I say this as somebody who makes metaphorical reaches for a living. That is a reach.
Yeah. And then he's like, why do I have this dog? It's terrible for cowboy stuff. It does nothing good.
I love that you've taken our timeless, who knows when it will come out bonus episode and somehow managed to insert three dad jokes.
Yeah, well, this is what the people want, John. And especially it's what they want when we had something go wrong and so we couldn't record an episode of the podcast. And so we had to dig into the archive and pick out this one, which we might not even ever release because maybe things will go perfectly forever.
Let me just go ahead and release some time-specific AFC Wimbledon news. Just now, while we were recording this, while I was listening to those jokes,
okay.
AFC Wimbledon drew their third-round FA Cup opponent. It could have been Arsenal. It could have been Manchester City. It could have been Liverpool. Instead, it's Boreham Wood.
Yeah, I was gonna go with Trip Basin.
Let's make up some potential English place names that could be fifth or sixth tier English soccer teams. Trip Basin is good. What about Ipsmouth Quarantine?
Yeah.
Ipsmouth Quarantine FC, the Wanderers.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna go with Hardmouth Bramble Through. And theirs is they play as the fighting bees.
There's of course the Smash Mouth FC All Stars.
Now this is the thing I think we could make happen, John. What about Broadtooth United? I want a song for Broadtooth United, like they're better on the pitch, but they can't bite as hard as these. We're Broadtooth United. We've got higher SATs. They don't have SATs there.
Aren't they the fighting bees? I mean, you've just got your own. Right. We're Broadtooth United. England's fighting bees.
Yeah, okay.
The truth is, I don't think we're going to do better than Broadteeth FC.
No, what about, I got one. What about, what about, let's, I'm going to say the first part and you say the second word. The first name of this football team is Nipple Switch.
Sure, yeah, the Nipple Switch Town Marauders.
Why does it sound right?
It sounds right. It would not surprise me in the least if there's a team somewhere in the seventh tier that's the Nipple Switch Town Marauders. And, you know, they've got their own culture. You know, they got like 25 season ticket holders.
Yeah.
And for those 25 people, being a Nipple Switch Town Marauder supporter is at the center of their identity.
It's a really big...
It's who they are.
Yeah, it's a really big deal for them.
And for the town of Nipple Switch, of course, it's amazing to have a football team, you know?
Yeah, how else are we gonna get through this cold, hard life? John, I don't know why we decided to make our best episode the bonus episode.
Sorry. It's all downhill from here, friends. That's as good as it gets.
Oh, God. Do you have any questions?
I don't have any questions from our listeners. That's over. Can I read you some real teams from the eighth tier of English football?
Sure.
There's a town called McLover.
If you had just said McLover, I would have been like, that's a great one, John.
It's McLover Football Club in Derby.
McLover FC.
Oh, it might be Mickleover, which is a real disappointment. I might have misread it. All right, Hank, before we descend into a full hour of discussing fictional English place names, here's a question from Hannah who writes, Dear John and Hank, is it socially acceptable to practice the banjo in my dorm room? There is no stated rule against playing the banjo in my dorm room, but I do not want to have a conversation about it if any of my dorm neighbors hear me and get annoyed. I can't ask the RA. Because I am the RA. Great twist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If I shouldn't play the banjo in my dorm room, where should I play it?
That's the better question.
Spelled backwards, Hannah.
Hannah, first of all, I feel like you should know the answer to this question. I always assumed that RAs knew about dorm room behavior.
Yeah, they
behavior.
Knew everything. There was no higher authority.
Second, I didn't understand your question initially because, of course, no, you cannot play banjo in your dorm room unless your roommate isn't there. But it appears that having become an RA, you have a single, which sounds
lovely. And in
lovely.
That case, first off, I think you can play the banjo if your roommate is there as long as they are playing the harmonica.
That's the only way you can play a banjo in a room with a person who is not like actually paying to watch you.
Yeah.
So they have to also be playing a harmonica or a washboard.
I don't have direct experience of having neighbors play the banjo, although I love banjo music, so I think I would be happy.
Uh-huh.
But when I lived in New York City, we lived directly, I've probably talked about this before because it had a huge impact on my life. We lived directly beneath a professional opera singer.
Yes.
And when you're a professional opera singer, you have to sing every day. Like, that's how you maintain.
You gotta do your job.
Yeah, it's like being a writer. You gotta write. Uh-huh. And so she had to opera sing. And at first I was like, man, this is super annoying because this person really goes through the scales. Loud. You know, it's like five or six octaves several times a day and booming. I mean, no microphone for this opera singer. This is a voice made for the Roman Colosseum. And, but then I slowly grew to really love it. So what I'm wondering is if Hannah's neighbors might become banjo fans through the process.
I think you can't expect it, but you also have to recognize that, like, we live in a society. And one time I was in a hotel room and my neighbor did call hotel security to tell me to stop practicing the questions that I was about to ask the president of the United States. So we're all in our moments, and it probably is good to to do it until you're told that it might cause a problem.
But the thing is, like, if you're in a position of authority, then people don't feel like they can come to you and say, like, I don't love this banjo playing.
Yeah, well, don't do it in the middle of the night. But look, if you have a good... But the question, where is a better place to play the banjo, is a great one. Because, of course, I think the best place to play the banjo is in the holler.
Does your dorm have a holler? Is.
Yeah. I'm not sure where you can find one, but that is where you got to play the banjo.
Alternately, if it doesn't have a holler, is there some kind of veil that you might be able to visit?
I think a veil is just a holler, but like a fancy one.
And if there is no veil or holler, can you at least go down by the river?
Yeah. If you can go down by the river or even a pond, like everybody's going to look over at that and be like, well, that makes sense. There's nothing about that that seems weird, honestly. It's odd that there wasn't a person playing a banjo there before.
Exactly. This river valley was incomplete pre-banjo. Uh-huh. I just read a history of the Orthodox Church. You know Casper Ter Kuile of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text and lots of other things?
Yeah.
He did this thing this year where he read a book every couple weeks with a different person. And, and the book that we picked was this history of the Orthodox Church, which was a book I never, ever would have read if it hadn't been for this two-person book club.
Of which Orthodox Church?
Like, well, funny you should ask. That is itself a whole hullabaloo that, believe you me, I'm not looking to get into. But the Orthodox tradition that is today present in Russia and Romania and Greece and other places as separate from what the book calls the Latin Church or the Roman Catholic Church. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is that while reading this book, I learned that in the Orthodox tradition, there were valleys that would contain hermits, like monks who were hermits. And if they were really good hermits who were really popular and seen as really holy and sacred, there would be other...
a popular hermit.
Yeah, you could be a popular hermit. This is a different time. Whereas now, I guess you could still be a popular hermit. Just ask J.D. Salinger. So what would happen is that other hermitages would pop up in the same valley. It would almost be like a community of hermits would develop because they were all inspired by this one great hermit. And I thought that was lovely.
Well, are they hermits anymore, or are they just a bunch of buds now?
Exactly. And so that made me think, if you start playing your banjo in the holler, maybe lesser banjo players will come with you. And then you will be a community of banjo players, and no longer will you be alone, Hannah, in your banjo playing.
Yeah, you'll be in a band that's called the Sleepy Holler Hannah Banjo Band.
I think actually it would be known, Hank, as Broadtooth FC and the Bluegrass Boys.
No, we're back.
We're back. We're back. I wasn't going to let it go. I require a callback.
Okay. John, this question I think is for you. It's from Tahani, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I recently went to New York City for the first time, which has been a dream trip for me for a long time. One of the biggest items on my to-do list was to visit the Museum of Modern Art, where Starry Night by Van Gogh is on display. Now, I've been to the National Archives in D.C. before, so I've seen the amount of security that a significant physical piece of history can receive. So imagine my surprise when I was just able to casually waltz up to the Starry Night painting that is everyone's default favorite painting. Obviously, there were cameras somewhere in the room, but there weren't any guards, no barriers, not even a written notice not to touch it. How is this allowed? How am I, a random teenager, just able to be near it without supervision? How has no one ruined it by now? Is it even the original? Are the art people lying to us? Concerned about the culture, Tahani."
This is a great question. Yeah. And I love the kind of conspiratorial thinking of like, is this really
this seems
it?
Wrong. If I can spit on the Starry Night, this must not be the Starry Night. It is just a
and
Starry
indeed,
Night.
And indeed, you can't spit on it for the record. Okay. But yeah, so there are a bunch of things at work here. And it's a really interesting question. Because when I look at Starry Night. My thought is also, this doesn't really look like Starry Night. Mm. Now, when I've gone to MoMA to see Starry Night, it was always pre-pandemic, so you weren't looking at the painting so much as you were looking at other people looking at the painting, mm-hmm. like as is the case for most really famous paintings right. in really crowded museums. Yeah. But it was a similar experience in the sense that it's, as I recall, it was not roped off. There were no visible security guards, and it did feel like you were there with the painting, yeah, or all these people nice. Were there with the painting. Yeah. And now, because of the pandemic, you have like timed entry, and MoMA is much less crowded, and you probably can sit alone with Starry Night for a little bit, which is a really cool experience. Or I guess I should say, would be a really cool experience, except for the thing that kind of bums it out for me, which is that, Tahani, you may not have been able to notice this because the glass is very, very, very clear, but there is glass. Ah. It's called museum glass. And I know for a fact it's over Starry Night. It's over most of the most valuable paintings sure. in most museums because they're almost impossible to ensure otherwise.
Right, because you don't want somebody to just go up there with a car key and be like, ha-ha!
Yeah, or to spit on it, yeah, for that matter.
Right.
And so this museum glass, which is really clear, and it's really, obviously it's really good glass, but it is glass. And for me, what makes Van Gogh, and by the way, we're saying Van Gogh, and I know,
we know.
Dutch people.
We know.
We're just not doing it.
We are who
because,
we are.
I mean, we can't pronounce anything. We certainly can't pronounce Van Gogh. So for me, like, what makes those paintings so extraordinary is the brushwork and the texture to the painting. Mm-hmm. And under museum glass, it really does flatten it out a lot. Like, it flattens your visual perception of it a lot. And so I think that's maybe why in that moment Tahani felt like, is this even the original? Mm-hmm. Because it does feel more poster-like
when it's under glass. Yeah.
When it's under glass than like a normal Van Gogh painting would.
Right.
Even in that same room, there are Van Gogh paintings that aren't under glass where you're like, wow.
Interesting.
That brushwork is really weird and has some real texture to it. And you don't see that as much when you look at Starry Night. Although it is an incredible, I mean, obviously, it's probably the most famous painting of the last 200 years. It's a good painting. I don't want to take anything away from it. But it does it does suffer a little for me under the glass.
Yeah. And obviously it has to have the glass because you got to protect the painting and also you have to insure the painting.
Right, right. And one of the sad things about humanity is that we all kind of know what would probably happen eventually if it weren't protected,
yeah,
in that way.
You know, somebody wants to, or somebody's, yeah. Yeah. Well, and like, is that a sad thing about humanity or is it just like there are outliers? And that is a part of how humanity has to be. And so like like the weird thing is that we have to choose certain paintings to be these icons. And, you know, Starry Night is very good, but it's kind of suffers from being an icon, which is true of actual human icons as well. You know, we have to center, as, you know, members of a culture, we center our attention on certain things. And that is sometimes to the detriment of the thing.
Yeah. Like when you look at that painting, it's very hard to see that painting as anything other than this iconic painting, mm-hmm. that's very famous. And so part of what you're feeling when you look at it is, oh my gosh, this is the famous thing in the flesh, or at least like insofar as I'll ever see it in the flesh. Yeah. And then you turn around and in the same room, there's another Van Gogh painting or a painting by another artist that isn't under glass, that isn't famous. And maybe because it isn't famous, it's able to move you or it's able to connect with you in a way that this image, because it's been so repeated in your mind, just can't. Mm-hmm. And I've always felt like there's something to me quite sad about that. But you're right. Like it's an inevitable feature of as you put it earlier, living in a society. I've never heard somebody say, unironically, we live in a society, but it's we do.
We do. I mean, I think that I think that all the time. I'm like, oh, why is this hard? Because we live in a society. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things are hard.
No. I agree. It's just like, it's a meme to say we live in a society. Yeah. I'm used to the meme. In fact, that phrase has become iconic in my mind so much that I struggle to engage with it without that level of irony inside my mind. Yeah. But of course, we do live in a society, and that is the root of the meme.
Where they come from.
All right, Hank, we got another question from Laura, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I recently moved to my grandparents' home to help take care of my 90-year-old grandmother and the house that she and my grandpa have lived in for the last 40 years. They've held on to a lot of things over the years, and I've been working on decluttering and cleaning things up. They have tons of books that no one in our family wants anymore, but I'm also pretty sure no one else in the world would want them. Plus, there are some religious books that I would rather not go into circulation, to be honest. My question is, what do we do with old books that no one wants? I don't want to give them to Goodwill if they'll just be a burden to Goodwill, but I also am not sure that I am ready to go so far as book burning. What do we do? I don't have a quirky sign-off, Laura.
Oh, I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on this, but I will say that there is a wide gulf of difference between burning a book and throwing one away. Lots of books get recycled. Yeah. And that is a very different vibe than, like, we must celebrate the destruction of this book in a party time atmosphere where we all say, down with the ideas, and these are thoughts that should never have existed in the world. And we are celebrating the destruction of these thoughts, which is, oof.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's nothing wrong with throwing a book away. I will say, though, that there's a pretty good chance that somebody does want
a lot of these books.
Yeah. And that somebody may really, really want them. Yeah. I'll give you an example. My great uncle, my great great uncle, my grandfather's brother, also Hank's grandfather's brother, wrote a novel in like 1932. And this was always part of our family lore growing up, that my great uncle had written this novel and it had been a big issue in their hometown and yada, 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 but that the book was out of print and nobody had a copy and nobody knew where you could ever find a copy. And then I found a copy.
Yeah, because the internet happened and you could start to search for stuff.
Yeah, that said, I still think there are only two or three copies of the book in the world.
Wow.
So it may be that there is somebody out there who really wants that book and doesn't know. And maybe giving it to Goodwill is a reasonably good way of doing that, because I don't know how Goodwill works, but like, they may check it against a database to say, are there people asking for this book? Maybe going to a used bookstore could do the same thing. I don't know the exact right way to deal with it, but like, I agree that there's nothing wrong with throwing away books, but there might be an audience for that book that has nothing to do with the content of the book, but instead it's like a personal connection or. Right. It's a book that they remember from childhood, or who knows? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I think that, like, the main thing is, like, you shouldn't become a rare book dealer suddenly because you're in charge of some of your grandparents' belongings. What you should potentially do is look into somebody who could give them a once-over and knows the space well enough to know what is a book that, like, there's 1,000 copies of it out there and nobody wants them, and what is a book that actually might have somebody somewhere who really is missing this from their life.
Yeah. 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 And there's a lot of ways to do that. I mean, so that's what I would do if it were me. But I do think that we are a little precious about books, sometimes physical books, in ways that we aren't precious about other physical goods.
Yes. Well, we all have to read Fahrenheit 451 when we're in high school. So we got that in our heads that this is a
thing. I think it is appropriate to be afraid of exactly the kind of book burning that you refer to.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because people also don't really throw away records in my experience. There's something about physical art that it's really hard to throw away. Like, I do not want to throw away any of the art that Sarah made, even the stuff that she made in high school. And she's like, it's fine to throw this away. I made it in high school. I don't I don't like it.
Yeah, it's like, do you want to keep around the copies of like Rosenthal Square that you wrote when you were in high school?
I had forgotten that that was the title of that story, Rosenthal Square. It's so weird that that book, that story was called Rosenthal Square, and then I became very good friends with somebody named Amy Krauss Rosenthal. That is such an Amy Krauss Rosenthal detail. Like she would love that coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
She would love that. I must have mentioned that to her at some point, I hope.
Well, the good news is, John, that's not on the internet, so no one can go find it. Because you sounded like you didn't want me to say the words.
So the backstory there, this is a story I wrote when I was in high school, and I liked it. It came in third place in my high school's like story contest.
Yeah.
But first place went to Daniel Alarcón, who went on to become a very, very successful. He just won a MacArthur Genius Grant.
It was a weird moment in high schools.
I didn't know it at the time, but like first place shouldn't have even counted.
Yeah. You got second.
And so I have fond memories of that story because it was really the first story that I completed, and it was, you know, the first story that I wrote for fun, you know, that wasn't for an assignment or anything. And I recently reread it and I was like, it's not great. It's not as good as I remember.
I'm surprised you had it handy to read.
Dad found it.
Oh, yeah, of course. I liked it. Yeah. I was like, wow, John is my brother. My older brother is amazing. He is so cool.
To read it now, you're like, boy, was this guy in love with Kurt Vonnegut. And it just reads sort of like a sort of echo shadow of the kind of Vonnegut sense of humor, where it reads like I had good taste, but not yet good execution.
Sure. Well, and that's a lot of early people's work. And also, like, it's hard when you read a lot of somebody who has a really powerful voice to get outside of that frame.
Maybe it's helpful to be imitative when you're a young writer or musician or artist or whatever. Because part of it is learning what you like about what you like.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, John, this podcast, as it happens, is actually brought to you by Rosenthal Square, Green. What's it called? Juvenalia? That you cannot and should not get.
Emphasis on the juvenile in Juvenalia. And of course, this podcast is also brought to you by Banjo in the Holler, the new album by the Sleepy Holler Hannah Banjo Band.
This podcast is also brought to you by Nipplewichtown FC. Nipplewichtown FC playing, they just pulled Manchester United in the FC Cup. It's huge for them.
The FC Cup. That's amazing. Never change. Never learn. Never learn. I wonder if it would be completely out of place to create merch for one of these fictional soccer teams. But anyway, we're moving on.
So this podcast isn't coming out. We don't know when it's coming out.
It's all wasted on a bonus episode anyway. This unmitigated gold. It's just going to be on a random Monday when one of us has COVID or something. Also, this podcast is brought to you by Living in a Society. Living in a Society. It's not just an ironic statement. It is also a fact.
It's really real. It's so real.
We should Google Nipplewichtown and make sure it's not a real place before we...
It's not. I already did.
Oh, great.
It sounded so real. I looked it up. This next question comes from Caitlin, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, this question is from my husband, who introduced it by saying, I have a question for those green boys. I thought it would only be polite to pass it on. Why does gum stick to everything except my teeth?" Do you know why, John?
I would assume because your teeth are kind of wet.
Yeah, it's because they're all, just like all the rest of your bones, they're wet.
Oh, no, not, don't say that. Don't tell me the rest of my bones are wet. Oh, no. Oh, God. Oh, God. Are you telling me that if I was chewing gum with my ulna, it wouldn't stick to my ulna?
Yeah, it's a wet ulna.
Oh, God.
Also,
I can feel all my bones. I can feel every one of them. They're all inside of me.
Your teeth are also very hard and have very, so they're not porous at all. So there's nothing for the gum to like sort of get into. That's one of the things but gum will regardless stick to a very hard, non-porous, dry surface. And gum would stick to your teeth if you dry them out first. And you can dry your teeth out. Not something you want to do like permanently or anything, but doesn't hurt them to dry them out. Just sort of stick them out there and breathe on them a bunch. Just blow a hair dryer into your mouth and then stick some gum to them. That'll absolutely work.
How can you still be talking after revealing that all my bones are wet?
It's a meme, John. It's a whole thing.
People have already
been through the process that you're going through right now.
I've never heard this before. This is deeply upset. I cannot tell you the extent to which I am feeling the existence of my bones, which I have never felt before. I am having an intense physical reaction to that news. I am aware of having a pelvis. I feel my finger bones.
I didn't like that. You did remind me about my pelvis, and
I have all of these bones that are holding me together.
This podcast is brought to you by Wet Skeletons. Is Red Skellington's brother.
That got me out. That pulled me right out. I'm good now. You know that guy's name is not really Red Skeleton, right?
Yeah, okay, good.
That's key. That's key to being able to enjoy the joke. Oh, that pulled me right out. Thank you. All right, let's move on quickly. This question comes from Andrew, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I am someone who doesn't go to bars very often, but I always see someone on TV shouting, 'The next round is on me.' Is that a real thing? Is the next round a predetermined amount and type of alcohol? What happens?" Andrew. This is gold.
I like the idea that you shout, "The next round's on me," but you can only get Coors Light.
Only tequila shots.
No, that's too much. Well, something.
But you can
Tito's,
say that.
Only Tito's.
You can say that. You can say, "Shots on me for the whole bar." Uh-huh. And then everybody in the bar gets a tequila shot, and you have to pay for X number of tequila shots. So, Andrew, there's a couple things to remember. One is that I would say most times somebody says the next round's on me, they are at a bar with between 3 and 5 people.
Right. And they are not getting it for the whole bar.
Or they're at a bar that only contains 3 to 5 people.
Which is a lot of bars. Often the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a lot of bars.
I have said the next round's on me once in my life. And
that's
like
cool,
Andrew,
John. That's pretty cool. That makes me feel like you're pretty cool.
Thank you. Like Andrew, I did not fully understand the commitment that I was making. I had seen something on TV and I thought, I'm feeling good. I've had an amazing day. The next round is on me. And goodness gracious, that was an expensive announcement.
Oh, John, did you skipped the most important part. Did they, at the moment that you said this, did everyone go, "Hey!"
It was a fairly significant "A."
Because my horrible fear would be, I'd be like, "Next round's on me!" And everybody would be like, "Cool, cool." And they just like sort of walk up quietly to the bar and be like, "Ah, that guy, what a sucker."
I feel like, I don't know the bartender experience of this, but I feel like it'd be kind of a bummer for the bartender because they've got to decide like what constitutes
when
the next
round. When is the
round
over? Yeah.
Am I sure that this person has only had one drink in this so-called round?
Right.
And then
and also,
like, there's
the
whole
the person,
like, tipping issue.
Is the person who said next round on me actually good for this?
Yeah. right. Sure. So I would argue, take on that responsibility with care. It is not a predetermined type of alcohol usually, so you don't know what you're buying when you announce next round's on me.
Next round's on me, but only cheap beers. Like, gotta go to the well, friends. I'm not getting you a Long Island iced tea with top shelf liquors.
PBR for the whole family. I love that you think the nicest mixed drink is a Long Island iced tea.
It's the most expensive one. It has like 6 shots in it.
Oh God, never change.
It's just expensive. I'm not saying it's nice. I love Long Islands.
I genuinely don't think anyone has said the sentence, "I love Long Island iced teas," in 10 years. I think it has been, I think the last time it was uttered was 2011. Nobody, and I mean nobody, likes a Long Island iced tea.
I do. I think they're very good. I like them a lot. They're amazing.
Wow. I just looked up how many beers a Long Island iced tea is equivalent to.
It's not good. Yeah.
4 beers.
Oh, that's all?
That's a lot of beers, Hank.
No, I know. I can't drink them.
If I had 4 beers, I haven't had a Long Island iced tea
probably
headache.
Since 2011.
Oh, my God.
Before that, I bet.
All right. Let's move on. This is Hank and John are too old to...
Next round's on me, and by next round, I mean I'm the only person here. And round is boba tea.
Nice. All right, Nick, before we get to the all-important but not time-sensitive news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, here's a question from G, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, but mostly Hank, I'm getting a little offended here." How/why do booster shots work? Does our immune system just forget how to recognize certain pathogens after some amount of time? G,
our immune system is amazing and complicated, and we do not understand all of how it works. So a lot of this isn't like, how does this work? It does work.
Right.
And that's a lot of how we... Unfortunately, like, it'd be nice if we understood all of the sort of amazing variables of our immune system. But what we can do is study really effectively, especially in a circumstance where we have a lot of people who are sick and a lot of people getting vaccines. We can study the efficacy of those vaccines and how it changes over time. And once you do that, you start to say, maybe we need to do additional shots. Whereas for some diseases, you don't need to do additional shots. Now, why this is... we don't know, especially because there are multiple ways that our body remembers, basically, different pathogens. So there are, like antibodies which can stick around for a certain amount of time, but do tend to wane, but then are always present in some amount. But sometimes that level is higher than other times. There are also like these cells themselves that can remember and become like specific to the pathogen, and they replicate themselves and remain there all of the time. Do they hang out in like certain parts of your body? Do we have a good way of testing whether or not they're there? Not really. So we just do studies to see how long the immunity to a disease lasts. And then you sort of bump up the immunity. And oftentimes what happens is with a second shot, you get sort of a lasting immunity where your body the first time is like, oh, this is a disease and I probably won't see it again. But if it sees it again, it's like, oh, this is one that I'm going to have to watch out for a long time. How the mechanism of how that works is very complicated. People know some things about it, but we don't sort of have the full story.
If you're interested, though, I really recommend Philip Detmer's book Immune, which talks about in a lot more detail the ways that vaccines work and why some vaccines are multi-dose, in addition to being a really fascinating introduction to the immune system, which I have to say I knew something about, but I had no sense of the astonishing complexity and really beauty of the human immune system. So
the idea that we have a class of cells that are responsible for killing other cells but like their biggest job isn't just to kill the bad folk, it's to not kill the body,
right?
Which is a difficult thing to do.
Very
like how
hard.
Does it tell us apart?
Yep. Very hard.
It's pretty amazing.
It's a great book. And if you don't know who Philip is, he's the founder and head writer of the YouTube channel Kurzgesagt, which you've probably seen, and is one of our favorite educational YouTube channels. So it's just a really great book. I loved it. Let's move on to the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Hank, I'll go first. AFC Wimbledon have done something really cool that makes me really happy, which is that they have re-signed one of my favorite youth players, whose name is Egli Kaja. And so Egli Kaja was a really promising youth player for Wimbledon. And it often happens that really promising youth players like just don't get a foothold in the game for a variety of reasons, just like any other career. And after going on loan a couple times and then ending up at Northampton Town, which only sounds fictional, he was out of the game for a little while and then re-signed for Wimbledon quite recently. Of course, our current manager, Mark Robinson, coached him when he was a little kid. And so it's really great to have him back at the club. I'm rooting so much for him. He has been at Wimbledon since he was like 10 years old, and he's just a great kid. Well, I should say now a great young man. And I'm really excited that he's back with the team. What's the evergreen news from Mars?
I've been trying so hard. Mars is so good. It's a good Brock.
I feel like almost all the news from Mars is evergreen news from Mars.
It is. Yeah, it is, I guess. In news from Mars, John, so you know how we have heard that the crater that the Perseverance rover is in is an ancient lake bed that was a long-term old lake where lots of layers of sediment got laid down over a very long period of time, potentially, you know, millions or even tens or hundreds of millions of years.
Yes.
Well, a group of scientists, and I can't tell you where they're from because I'm doing this off the top of my head, have proposed a counterclaim, a potential other way that these layers could have been formed. And oftentimes this can be sort of pitched by the scientific press as like, we were wrong, or maybe we were wrong. But like really what it is it's saying this is one way, a long period of time, a lake existing on the surface of Mars is one way this could have happened. Another way is like a series of many years of rainstorms followed by the evaporation of the lake over and over and over again.
Oh.
But it would have been more sort of like a puddle vibe,
right,
where the lake wouldn't have been a long-lasting lake. It would have been puddles for, you know, puddle, 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 puddle.
It fills, it over empties, a long it period fills, of time. It empties, it fills, it
yeah.
empties.
And that's just sort of like so the clearest, most basic explanation would be this was a lake bed. But there are other ways that at least the layers that we're looking at right now could be explained. And as we look deeper at the layers, there are even some clues that might lead us to believe that it would have been more of a transient water type place. Now that's still liquid water sticking around and probably still just subsurface, a lot of liquid water sticking around for a long time. Like it might've been kind of a muddy place. What do we know? It was billions of years ago. So we will continue to do the research, and we will have a lot better idea once we just get our little feet there and get to poke around with our own human pokers. That's maybe not the best way to say that.
In 2028 or later.
In 2028 or later. In 2027 or sooner. So that's, you could probably, with that information I just gave you, look up the story, which I read and then couldn't find. I won it.
Well, Hank, thank you for potting with me. Thanks to everybody for listening. I hope that you're having a nice season.
We are as well.
Up the
What a great season it is.
Up the Broadtooths.
Up the Broadtooths. This podcast is edited by Joseph Tunamedish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas. Our communications coordinator is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant is Debuki Drakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.